Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, September 24th, 2018, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And as often, not always, not even usually, but oftenly, not a word, I am recording this intro from a quaint hotel room, and hopefully the audio quality is A-okay, because I am excited to announce this week's guest. But before I do, I want to thank those of you who are making Talk Nerdy possible. Wow, this is what I get for recording these intros so late at night. I want to thank those of you who continue to help out with the show. Remember, this really is a joint effort amongst all of us. I, you know, produce and host the show, I book the guests and all that, but I have so much help from my incredible assistant, Noelle Dilworth, from the incredible team at Pro Podcast Solutions that helps me edit the show every week, and also from all of the feedback and the insights and the recommendations and like the words of encouragement from all of you out there in the podcastverse, coining that one. Of course, there are many ways to support the show. Honestly, the most important way is to share it with your friends and your family, rate and review it, get people talking about it, turn people onto it, see if they want to give it a listen. That's what matters most. But you can also support the show by, you know, being a patron of the show. And the best way to do that is to visit patreon.com/talknerdy. You can pledge as little as 50 cents. Maybe a dollar an episode. It really does go an awfully long way. And the top patrons this week include Rob Schreck, Timothy Glover, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. All right, guys. This week, I had the opportunity to connect with Dr. Kevin Heinlein. He is a scientist doing some pretty cool stuff. There's a nice pause there for emphasis. He is actually now has recently moved to the Department of Astronomy at Stewart University in Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona. And he is working on his postdoc research, doing research involved with the JWST NIR cam. Now, he's going to explain why we're calling it the JWST during the show, but you've probably heard of it as the James Webb Space Telescope. He's also super interested in galaxies, black holes, other cool things that happen in space, and we're going to talk about some of them right now. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Kevin Heinlein. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. This is really exciting.
I know. So you were recommended by a mutual friend, Allison Becker, who I'm going to have on the show soon. And if you guys don't know Allison, you probably know her best from being the reporter on Parks and Rec. But she is an incredible actress and she has done a million different things. And she was also a regular sub-in on a TV show called Take Part Live that I used to work on. And that's where we met. How do you know Allison?
I met her at a conference and then we dated for less than a year.
Nice.
Yeah.
So we've all got an astronomer in our background. I hate to admit it, but we do.
We're fun novelty. We're just a fun little, like a little Susan of astronomer as like Pepper on a relationship background. It's a fun little thing.
I'll tell you what, if you wanted to, we could spend the next 10 minutes talking about how astronomers are really hard to date. But instead, maybe we'll talk about what it is to be an astronomer and a special kind of astronomer, which is an astronomer who really cares deeply about science communication.
Yeah.
Because, of course, that's something that I care about. That's something that we talk about a lot on Talk Nerdy. And so I'm so glad that she connected us. You are in Arizona, right?
Yes, I live in Tucson, Arizona, which, if you don't know where that is, it's real far south. We're a couple hours from the border between here and Mexico. And it's an incredible town if you haven't visited. I like thinking about it like a little Austin in terms of like great culture and great arts and food and stuff. And it's also the home of the University of Arizona, which is where I work.
Oh, nice. Okay. So, you know, I'm from Texas, but not Austin, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I know that's the only place kind of worth going in Texas. I'm from North Texas.
Marfa's kind of cool.
Marfa. Yeah, I guess that's true. Marfa has gotten a little cooler. Yeah. I'm from Plano, not as cool, which is right outside of Dallas. So you are, you're an hour ahead of me here in LA. I can never keep straight Arizona's time.
It's exact same time right now. Arizona abides by no laws for time. So, you know, if anything, you guys are all out of whack with us. But no, it's 6 o'clock right now for me, and I think it's 6 o'clock for you in LA.
It is on a Friday. We are very dedicated to our work.
I left, so I've been... I've tried to create a culture at the universities that I go to of like friendship and openness, especially about just working. I think a lot of scientists like to pride themselves on like working late on a Friday. And I think that that's a bad thing to do for your mental health. So I started a thing called Flask here, where the grad students and postdocs go out to get drinks. And I biked from Flask to here to record this. So I'm very dedicated.
Aw, that is so nice. And so you left a bunch of grad students behind.
Yes. All these grad students tip their Modellos to me as I walked out the door to get on my bike to right over here.
That is so nice of you. Yeah, because I can't imagine that you all went out drinking and are already home by six.
They are not. I am.
Yeah, you know, we used to do that with our professor when I was working on my master's back in Texas. We all went out on Friday nights for a Friday night lab meeting at Cool Beans, which was a bar in Denton, Texas, where I went to school. And I love the weather. That's something I miss about Texas. It's one of the only things I miss about Texas.
Yeah, like right now we're getting the monsoon season, which when I've gone through Texas, I've seen that they've had a very similar, like that kind of crazy thunderstorm that just rolls through. And that's what's happening here in Tucson. In fact, it's got clouds and like, I wouldn't be surprised if we had a little bit of a thunderstorm tonight. And it's my favorite way to end a hot summer is through this incredible weather.
Oh, and it's beautiful. The lightning storms are so beautiful.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it never rains here in LA. I don't remember what rain looks like.
I got my PhD in UCLA, and I'm from Orange County, so I know like the lack of weather in Southern California. It makes you soft, really.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so you know what it's all about. So, but now that you're in Arizona, how long have you been there now?
I've been here for 3 years. I'm working on a project that... So, I'm a postdoctoral researcher, so I haven't yet become a professor. But I'm on a very interesting postdoc that most postdocs, you know, I don't know if your listeners know the kind of weird waiting period that scientists have to go through these days before getting a professorship. Once they finish grad student life, they kind of get locked in a weird purgatory of postdoc research, which is both good and bad. This is my second postdoc. I had a postdoc at Dartmouth in New Hampshire, and that was for 3 years. And now I've just finished 3 years here. But it's a postdoc working on a space telescope, so it's kind of more open-ended. And so I'll probably be here a little bit longer, especially through the launch of the telescope.
Oh, and so your interest is actually to end up at a university as a full-time professor. You don't want to be a staff scientist.
I do not know. Right now, I'm doing research science, but on the side, I started doing a huge amount of science outreach, science communication, public speaking sort of things, stargazing things that like have been really very instrumental in teaching me like what it is that I love about science. And research is fun and I'm really enjoying it. But like, I think that I have a different calling than just working at the university level. I think that really it would be way more fun to work in educating people, especially if I move back to someplace like LA. There's a place in LA called A26 that is this writing workshop. And I think that like something in that vein for science would be really amazing to essentially do science tutoring. But we can talk about that later. I don't think I want to be a professor, essentially, which maybe I shouldn't say on a big podcast.
No, you absolutely should if that's how you feel. You know, we talk a lot on the show about what it means, like what science communication means if that ends up being your career, whether you want to do it in an allied way with your research, you know, staying in academia, whether you want to go into journalism. There's a lot of different outlets, whether you want to be a freelancer and kind of what the honest hurdles are going to be, but also what kinds of like really great freedoms come along with that. But I also love to talk about the fact that like being a professor is not the only option that you have in front of you if you get a PhD.
Nope. This is something I think a lot about. And I have since I graduated. I graduated from UCLA in 2012, got my PhD through someone who is an incredible scientist. But she's an incredible scientist who always wanted to be a researcher. And so she went and this is what she wanted. And now she has it. And so when I was like looking at career options, there was just not a lot of like, she didn't have a huge amount of advice because she had been locked on this like rocket ship to the position she is in now. And she's one of the greatest scientists I've ever worked with. But like, I didn't want to be that because I'm not up for that amount of like, you know, hard work and stress that she goes through. And like, I also felt like my calling was somewhere else. But when you talk to people who are above you, your mentors, often they won't have an idea because they are people who wanted something and then got it. And so like, you know, it's rare that someone like waffled a little bit, especially because at major R1, what we call R1 research institutes, like they are the best of the best who like had like three or four different offers from major universities and had to choose one. And they got this plum, awesome, super good job and are working really hard at it. But they have no advice for someone who's like not at their level of like intensity for science and for science research.
It really is like a sampling bias, right? Because it's like, wait, my own advisor who is supposed to help me make these kinds of decisions by virtue of who they are would never be in a position to make those decisions because they went straight through and didn't stop. I see that a lot with my friend. You know, I have a lot of friends here in LA who are PhD graduates of Caltech and Caltech ruined them for science. You know what I mean? It's science. They love science. And like a lot of my friends were in this like nerdy group that we've branded called the Nerd Brigade. And we all like work in science communication in one way or another. And a lot of them went to Caltech and got PhDs there and like have absolutely no interest in doing anything in academia ever again.
Yeah.
But it's hard because there's very few mentors in the like, what about the alternative career space? And so that's where I think podcasting, television programming, these kinds of conversations are actually really important because, you know, I'll hear from people who listen to the show sometimes. Sometimes they say listening to your show motivated me to go back to school, which is like, oh my gosh, tears in my eyes. I'm so excited. And sometimes they say it motivated me to switch careers. And I'm like, oh my gosh, tears in my eyes. I'm so excited.
That's great. That's really important.
Like Both of those things are good.
Yeah. Congratulations.
And so it's really cool to see that you are actively working. You're a working scientist right now. You're a postdoctoral researcher. And, you know, you may stick it out. You may not. You're kind of in that place where you're trying to figure it out. But before we talk about all the good SciComm, because, I mean, that's honestly my favorite part, let's talk a little bit about the active research you do. You work on James Webb, don't you?
So I work on James Webb, yes. One of the grad students told me that I should refer to it as JWST. Because of the politics behind Mr. Webb.
Yeah, James Webb is a human being.
There's a longer story and a longer dialogue that I think should be had about naming it after this guy who may have had some personal politics that I don't quite agree with. But the progress, the telescope I work on, JWST, is NASA's next flagship, large, expensive mission that will be like kind of the cousin of Hubble, which is, you know, like it now coming on 20 years of flight. James Webb will, or JWST will launch in a couple years and be the next really big mission for looking at all kinds of things, including what I do, which is look for like at very, very far away galaxies and black holes and stuff.
So, okay. Lots to unpack here.
Yes.
When we talk about Hubble, some people may know, Hubble is a telescope that is in orbit.
Yes. So Hubble is a telescope that was launched, as I said, about 20 years ago. It was launched on a space shuttle and let go from the space shuttle. It orbits our planet, which is why when it was discovered that it needed to be tweaked a little bit because of some of the optics, they could send a space shuttle up there, grab it, you know, fix it, add some more optics in there to correct for this. And then years later, they would go and do another servicing mission to go and replace instruments on there as well. And so it's in orbit around our planet. And so that's why when you apply for time on a telescope like Hubble, most telescopes here on the planet, you apply for nights. But with Hubble, you apply for orbits, which is kind of a cute way of them delineating time as it orbits our planet.
JWST. Yeah, that's cool.
Is not going to orbit our planet. It's actually going to go a million miles away beyond the orbit of the moon and sit in a spot that's like a kind of a special spot for the gravity of the Earth and the sun pulling on it. A spot called L2, which is just a silly Lagrange point 2 for those of you who care a lot about orbital dynamics, I guess. But it's just a spot that's about a million miles away between the sun and the Earth. If you just draw a straight line out a million miles from the Earth, you plop the telescope down there and it will kind of orbit that. Which means if something goes wrong with that telescope with JWST, it's a little harder for us to go fix it.
Yeah. So when things went wrong with the Hubble telescope, people did go, like astronauts would go and service it.
Yep. There's there's these wonderful pictures of astronauts out there capturing it with, you know, using using space shuttle and I think the Canadarm, which is this the thing to grab it, to hold onto it. And it's a pretty cool thing that it was able to do that. In fact, I think that the start of the film Gravity is like Sandra Bullock fixing Hubble, like a, you know, you like, and so I think it's like a very, like it's a thing that we've done enough to be put into a movie. But JWST can't sit as close to the Earth as Hubble does by virtue of the fact that it doesn't operate at the same wavelength range as Hubble. So Hubble is a 2.4 meter, Hubble, the size of Hubble, for those of you in the audience, if you want to get an idea of how big a space telescope is, Hubble's about the size of a bus. And so its mirror is 2.4 meters, which means it's a little taller than the average person if you were to like put it on its side.
Wait. I have to think about this for a second. So I have a Celestron Next Star.
Okay.
8. So it's a Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope that's got an 8-inch whatever. And I can see galaxies with this thing if it's dark enough outside. Like,
yeah,
I can
pretty
see
nearby
some
galaxies.
Stuff. Yeah, I can see stuff that's really far away. I can see like all the Messier objects. Like, it's amazing. And you're talking Hubble's is how big?
2.4 meters.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
It and was. So, and with telescopes, like bigger is way better because it goes like not just like linearly where like, oh, you're going from 8 inches to 2.4 meters is, you know, you multiply the sizes. No, it's a square because it's an area. It's a collecting area. So you got to think about a telescope as a big light bucket, like hoping to capture just light that's streaming through the universe. And if you have a bigger bucket, you're going to capture more light. And so Hubble was profoundly good at capturing like very, very far away light. And so it is the tool that we most rely on for finding the farthest galaxies. There's a lot of things Hubble did really well, but one of the things was because it was such a large mirror in space where it didn't have the atmosphere to kind of blur things out, it was one of our primary methods for finding incredibly faint, distant galaxies.
Okay. And so for researchers who study Hubble images or Hubble data, you know, they're looking at individual points of light kind of, or clusters of light that are really far away. But for people, like everyday people who like to enjoy the pretty pictures, like pretty much every beautiful image that we're used to seeing that's not of Earth, I shouldn't say pretty much, but a lot of them are thanks to Hubble, aren't they?
Yeah. Most of the things you see printed on yoga pants these days from space, that's a Hubble image. Hubble,
yes,
like
we love those like, nebula and yeah, those, exactly. all those galaxies.
And those are all mostly things in our own galaxy. Like Hubble was amazing at taking these pictures of essentially like fluorescent gas nebulae around baby stars. Or like the remnants of a star that has died and has lit up the cloud of gas around it or exploded at some point and lit up the gas around it. And those are the most of the, what people think about when they think about Hubble images are these incredible pictures of things within our own galaxy that are these gorgeous gas clouds lit up by some, you know, stellar light source. But what people have also, I think a lot of people have seen is that Hubble took one of the more famous Hubble pictures, this thing called the Hubble Deep Field, which is where essentially this one tiny patch of sky was just hammered away with Hubble, using a bunch of the instruments on Hubble and like just to really, really get the faintest, farther away galaxies. And it was like essentially, we call it like a pencil beam, this like tiny region that was just incredibly far away. And that image, I think, is really iconic of Hubble's mission as well, because it was an image that only really could have been taken with the clarity and depth with the Hubble Space Telescope.
And so this is the image that like everybody has as their background on their computer. It's the black background with all these little spots of light that almost look like stars. But if you look more clearly, you'll see that some of them are spiral shaped. Yep. That's
I show it and
field.
I tell everyone that if it has spikes, it's a star. And there's like two stars in the image. The field was chosen to be relatively free of stars along that path through our galaxy. But everything else is a galaxy, which means everything else is, you know, 100 billion stars, 10 billion stars, all in one little smudge that you can kind of put your thumb in front of one and be like, I'm covering 100 billion stars. I'm covering 100 billion stars. Galaxies that stretch back between like local E all the way back to the farthest things we've ever seen.
Oh my gosh. And so, and to be clear, when you say like there's two stars in the image, you don't mean that there are only two stars. You mean there are two stars that are close enough to us that they're in between us and yes. all these beautiful galaxies that are far away.
What I mean
away.
Is two individual stars, not stars that are inside of a galaxy.
Yeah.
Like, because when you see stars in any astronomy image, like individual stars, those are all not only stars in our own galaxy, but generally stars that are relatively nearby in our galaxy,
yeah,
like our little neighborhood.
They're kind of in the way. It's so hard to make sense of depth
yeah.
when we look at an image like this.
Yeah. And I'm going to get crazier because we haven't even talked about JWST and what I'm working on,
yes.
which is the next generation of that exact image.
And is that because Hubble going to die at some point?
Well, so actually, the thing about Hubble is that Hubble is right now limited mostly budgetarily. Like,
okay.
this is the thing where people who are listening, you should appreciate NASA, and you should appreciate NASA to the point where you vote and look for NASA funding in the people you vote for, because yeah. NASA right now is operating on a shoestring of the United States government budget, and NASA's budget has some money allocated for Hubble servicing and Hubble, like, you know, mission support. And that is what keeps Hubble, you know, going as a research tool. And the thing about what I'm working on now, JWST, is mm-hmm. that is not going to like replace Hubble. It's going to essentially work with Hubble, and there will still be a need for Hubble while JWST is being, you know, used. So it will at some point die, you know, like it will be needed to like bring it into orbit. It'll probably like, unless we have some plan that I've not ever heard of to go collect it and bring it into the future Smithsonian, it probably is going to be a controlled reentry into the planet. But like, mm-hmm. that's not on the docket right now. Mostly we have funding through the launch of JWST and a little bit further for Hubble. And so that's going to be really exciting because of the fact that Hubble operates at a wavelength range that is not done in space. It operates from the ultraviolet through a little bit into the infrared, ultraviolet, optical, infrared of light, the wavelengths of light that we can see with our eyes, and a little bit shorter wavelength in the ultraviolet, the UV, and a little bit longer into the infrared. But that no one operates in the ultraviolet, you know, like in space, like Hubble does. And so Hubble is an amazing niche right now, and it's still very useful and still people propose for it. One of my colleagues, we just put in a Hubble proposal and got time. I was just talking with grad students about them putting in Hubble proposals and getting Hubble time. It's still in use and still one of the cutting edge instruments, even though it's 20 years old.
Amazing. And so the issue here is that JWST is not a redundant Hubble. It's
no.
offering something completely different
yes.
and slightly more, I guess, I don't want to say more intense, but you're able to do a little more with it because it's much further away.
Well, what it is, it's not that it's further away. It's that James Webb or JWST operates in the infrared.
Gotcha.
It's an infrared telescope. And so it starts essentially where Hubble kind of falls off. And so it operates well outside of all of the images that you will eventually see with JWST are not things that our eyes could see. They're infrared mm-hmm. light from various sources. And that comes into play in a bunch of different really incredible ways. Infrared light is important within our own galaxy because there is a lot of dust in our galaxy and certain wavelengths of infrared light just pass right through dust. So if you care about things that are shrouded in dusty cocoons, like early starbirth, and you want to see stars right as they're being born, but Hubble wasn't able to because it couldn't see through the dust, JWST will be able to see through that, which is really cool. But more importantly for what I do, the universe is expanding. And that expansion means that galaxies are moving far away from us. And the farther they are away from us, the more that their light is what we call redshifted. It's taken from one wavelength and stretched out to longer wavelengths, meaning the host of information that a galaxy gives off in the optical is pushed into the infrared. And so if you want to find and study the farthest galaxies that humans have ever found and discovered, what you want is an infrared telescope with a giant mirror way far away from anything that's warm. And so JWST is not 2.4 meters, it's a 6.5 meter telescope.
Wow.
Its mirror is a little bit longer than if you had like a giraffe standing up. The mirror is a little taller than a standard giraffe.
Wow.
It's enormous gold-plated 18 hexagonal mirror segment mirror that is going to be sitting in space with four infrared instruments essentially primed to take what Hubble did for that incredibly deep image and do it better and deeper with a better resolution. It is like a giant light bucket that makes your Celestron look naive.
Well, I'm sure it costs a hell of a lot more than my Celestron, too.
That is an aspect of this that we can talk about.
But. And so this is, some people may have even seen images of this when they were, you know, reading articles about it or searching online. It looks like a giant, like, beehive.
Yeah, it's a big old honeycomb structure.
Yes. It's got like these big, gorgeous, like, it almost looks like foil, like you said, like gold.
Yeah, it is gold plated just on the surface, a tiny amount of gold, like if you took all the gold and put it, it'd be like a little ball that you could hold in your hand, essentially. Mm-hmm. A tiny thin layer of gold that's sprayed on there that is really good at reflecting the infrared light. The thing about large mirrors is there are not a lot of places that, there's a couple reasons why you wouldn't want to put large mirrors on telescopes anymore. One, there are not a lot of places that can mill large mirrors. There's a place actually here in Tucson, underneath the football stadium, there's a mirror lab that grinds large 6 to 8 meter mirrors. But there, it's very relatively rare because if you screw up a mirror like that, like it's, you know, back to the draw, you have to redo it. Like you got to get these things perfectly ground. Okay. However, we now know that you can take individual mirror segments, generally they're in hexagons, and you can make a bunch of them pretty small that are like milled to certain specifications and then join them together, and they can add up to essentially one large mirror, which is what JWST does. It's also, if you've heard of the Keck telescopes in Hawaii, which are some of the largest optical telescopes in the world, they're 10 meter telescopes. They're also this honeycomb hexagonal structure. JWST is 18 of these. It's a shape that's a 30-sided polygon. It's called a tricontagon, which is a fun word that I did not know before working on this. And yeah, it adds up to about a 6.5 meter diameter telescope.
It's just beautiful. And where are they fashioning it? I'm looking up pictures. Is it at Goddard?
So it was assembled at Goddard a couple years ago. I was working on there because I work. So the reason that I work with the telescope is that here at the University of Arizona, the primary camera, NIRCam, was designed and developed under the primary investigator, Marsha Rieke, my boss, who she is like a, she's just like an old hand with space telescopes. She worked on Hubble. She worked on Spitzer with her husband, George. She's like one of the like people that I think needs to be celebrated more in terms of her history of working on space telescopes. Mm-hmm. And she's the primary investigator on this instrument, NIRCam, which is the main camera. They were doing a lot of testing of that at Goddard Space Flight Center, which is outside of Baltimore, a couple hours south near the university. And that was where, while they were testing the instruments in cryo vacuum, in like when they dropped the temperature and put it in vacuum, they were testing it. They were in another room over in this giant clean room, slowly and painstakingly assembling the mirror from all the individual mirror segments. So when I was like up late at night doing a shift of testing, I would like go and look in the viewing window as they would like with this big robotic arm put the incredibly delicate mirror on top of the back plane and then attach it all there and then go do the next one. And they assembled them all there, then stood it up to point at that viewing window so people could take selfies in the JWST mirror, which is pretty amazing. But then after that, they took it and did and folded it up. Because that's the other thing about why you'd want to make it with segments is that JWST has to fit inside of a rocket. So it can't be this big mirror. We don't have rockets that are that large. So the sides kind of fold in, these like little wings on the side, the three mirrors on either side of the hexagon fold in. And so they folded it all up and shipped it across to Houston last year, where they tested it at Johnson Space Flight Center. They took the mirror and the instruments and put it in a giant vacuum chamber and tested the way that the mirror can essentially, all the individual mirrors have actuators so that you can kind of collect the light better onto the instruments.
Oh, there's so many moving parts. I'm so scared.
I am too.
Oh, gosh.
I am too. But I, as a person who's worked on the testing, I have never in my life worked on with people who are as thorough as NASA and European Space Agency engineers. My goodness, the amount of work, if you wanted to do any tiny bit of change to the testing, the amount of people who have to sign off on that and like the, like everything was stopped if there was any issues. Everything has a redundant. The redundant had to go through equally stringent testing. Like, there is a lot of moving parts, but they're all working. And it's pretty amazing how much moving parts are working and how much new technology has gone in there, but yet how much is working and how excited we are to just get the dang thing up in space.
Yeah, I have a friend. She's actually been on the show, if you guys remember, probably one of the earlier episodes, Holly Bender, who's a part of that nerd brigade I mentioned. But she is an optical engineer at NASA's JPL. And so she, you know, she sometimes works on CubeSats. I think she's doing some stuff on Europa Clipper. I could be wrong. She does a lot of near Earth stuff. But just the amount of effort and time that goes into developing these spec tools, like these little lenses that have to be so perfect to parameter. I mean, it's no wonder things like this take years.
Yep.
And like literal years, like even up to decades.
I was always stunned when I would go to testing and learn that the thing that I was going to be testing was the like an actuator arm that would just push a mirror into the beam once the telescope was up and we were turning NIRCam on. It would have to be done once, right? Once the telescope was turned on and everything, we're not going to like stow the telescope away. So this actuator arm has to work once. And so the amount of testing that that would have to do for to make sure the arm would go out and then it would retract so that we could run the secondary motor, the redundant motor that we should never have to use to move the little mirror out. And like how many times we have to do that. And like just like they know that when this telescope comes up there, there's not much you can do if something goes wrong. So everything is tested and tested and tested. And it's been really incredible to work with these people who, for whom, like to me, it's maddening. But for them, this is their job and they take it incredibly serious. And it's a very, very like important thing to do all of this testing and to make sure they know the testing. And like, it makes me very, very proud to work with these. And also it makes me feel safe. Whereas if I did not know all this, I would be in the exact same camp as you, which is,
yes.
Oh my gosh, what if it breaks? What if it breaks?
Yeah, because I mean, imagine you've got something that costs billions of dollars
and
it flies up to how far away is this
going? A million miles.
Pretty far.
Yeah.
And then like, it doesn't open. You know, like that would be devastating.
Well, in that case, this will be the last will and testament of I will just disappear. No one will know where I've gone to. I trust that it will work because of the people who, you know, like, you know, I really the person who feels like is Marcia. The way that Marcia like guides not just us with NIRCam, but a lot of the people, she is like the type of captain where if you know, she was the commander of my like battleship in like the 1800s, I would just like, I'd go to war for her. Like she is very much confident in these things, does not mince words, tells you when something is concerning, but like she is confident that this will work. And I believe her. And so like having a person like that be the person who's, you know, one room over to, if you get worried, like, what about this? What about this? Like, and she's like, that's not something I would worry about. Okay. I don't worry about it. She's great.
And so the thing is, like, doing research on JWST or the work that you're doing, I mean, this is something that hasn't even launched yet.
Yeah, so that's what's been really fun about this job is that what we're doing is we're essentially planning. I like to talk about it like when you build a space telescope instrument, like we've done here at the University of Arizona, you are given a certain amount of time. We are gifted like some large number of hours in the early cycles of the telescope. And that time is guaranteed. We don't have to propose for it. It's guaranteed hours to do with as we want. And so Marcia has divvied it up among the science teams. And like we created a survey that is when the telescope launches, we will look at essentially the same region that Hubble looked at, this deep field. But we'll look at it and tile it with a larger area and to a much deeper depth. And then have a lot of ancillary data as well. And we're working with the Europeans who are working on a different instrument that's a spectrograph, like a prism that takes the light from individual galaxies and can pass it over the prism to like look at it as a function of wavelength. And we're working with them to develop this incredible survey, which we've called JADES, which is the James Webb Deep Extragalactic Survey. And this is a survey that will be a legacy survey. Other people for many years will mine this data. But for right now, what we're essentially planning for, the metaphor I like to use is, it is as if Marcia said, here's a lot of land in the 1800s in like central to northern California where we know there's gold. And in fact, every mountain here is just full of gold. So what are the tools you're going to use to mine for that gold? And so over the next couple of years and in the last couple of years of working on here, we've been developing the tools that we will need to look at this incredible data set. And the problem is we are limited to what we know from what Hubble did and what ground-based telescopes have done. And JWST will open up such new avenues of types of galaxies and distances and like shape, like we have no idea. So me and one of my colleagues, another astronomer named Christina Williams, along with some of the European colleagues, we developed essentially like a fake catalog of galaxies, a mock catalog, like a fake universe that where we extrapolate a lot of what we know out into weird ways to essentially say, okay, we don't have our real catalog, so let's make a fake catalog that we think maybe, in fact, we're hoping it's not anything like what we actually get, because that's where science, it gets fun. Let's make this fake universe so we can make fake images and then see if we can take those fake images and use our tools to recover properties of galaxies to see how well we do. And so over the last year, we finished this earlier this year, this fake tool, published it. And now I've been using the fake images to try and see how well we can look at those images of galaxies and figure out how far away they are, which is like essentially saying, how is it that someone can look at the data from JWST and say, this is the farthest thing the farthest galaxy humans have ever found? I'm working on that problem right now, which is really exciting and also terrifying.
And also, it sounds really hard.
It's hard, but it's made easier by the fact that JWST was designed to solve and answer this specific problem of like, how can you do this?
Okay.
Like, and there's many tools that have been developed that I'm using, but also like, I'm developing my own tools as well to integrate with that, where we can do this like with a high scale, like, you know, like where we're confident in our results essentially. Mm-hmm. And like, it's hard from images, but it's a thing where I am confident that we will find galaxies that Hubble would never like be able to see, galaxies, not just that are close by and very faint, but also those incredibly far away things because of the fact that JWST is an infrared telescope. And it's been really exciting. And to think about like the moment a couple of years down the line where we actually put this into practice, where I'm not just working on a fake galaxy set of galaxy images, but instead I've actually got these data. And for like one moment, I'll be looking at my computer and I'll be like, oh, there it is. That is the farthest galaxy humans have ever found. And like for just one moment, I'll like see how, you know, Kevin Heinlein has pushed the frontiers of science that tiny little bit. And then I have to email all the team and say, okay, here's our candidates. And now everyone double check to make sure I'm not a complete idiot. And then, you know, and then we try and quickly publish these things. But like for a little bit moment, they'll be like, they're like, years of effort will pay off in this like incredible little moment of like, oh my gosh, this is it.
Yeah, light, no one's traveled, ever seen this before.
Yeah, 13.3 billion years of light traveling through space slowly, painstakingly to get caught by this one telescope in this one moment so that we can go, ah, there it is. That's the farthest galaxy we've ever seen right there.
That's so cool.
It's really, I'm really excited.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, just the idea as a scientist, right? I think it's kind of the dream that every scientist has deep down, to behold something, to experience something that nobody has ever beholden or experienced before. I mean, that's really the fundamental drive of kind of the explorer spirit, isn't it?
When I work with grad students and undergraduates, I like to really take a moment, because I think scientists like get into a mindset of like, I don't need that. That's not like, I just want to keep going. What's the next project? What's the next? And I like really take a moment with undergraduates and grad students that I work with. I stop them when they've made a, like a little discovery, no matter how like little. Like I was working with this undergraduate a couple of years ago, and there was a moment that he sent an email being like, okay, I reduced these data, and I think this is this type of object. And I had to like email him back. I was like, Raphael, you just discovered your first black hole. Before you did this work right here, no one knew that this was a black hole in this galaxy, and now they do. You've discovered a black hole.
Wow.
And like he mentioned, he started grad school actually here at the University of Arizona this year. And he mentioned in passing, like, he still has that email. And like, I think that like giving people a pause to remember why they do it, it sometimes in any field, like you have to like celebrate even weird minor accomplishments, even like a thing where like your lab results turn out the way, you know, like you were hoping or whatever, like any little thing like that. Otherwise you can forget why you do it. Like you can that the reason that we are exploring is because like, it's just for the pure sake of like understanding the human experience against the weirdness of our universe. And so like having a moment of saying like, this is a new black hole, this is the farthest galaxy, this is a, you know, this is a bacteria and how it works, or this like this is why you do it. And so if you don't celebrate that, you're denying yourself that like actual pleasure of like being a human being and like exploring new worlds, right? Like that's a cool thing.
I love too that sort of in this weird esoteric space, which is science, which a lot of people don't realize. I mean, it feels esoteric historically, the way that we've kept it very separate. And that's something going back to SciComm, something that we're all actively trying to break those barriers. But I love how it's like some small minor thing, like discovering a new black hole. And it's like, you know, his Twitter, you know, his Twitter just says like, I discovered a black hole.
Yeah.
Like, that's like,
and
his
you
bio.
Should. You should.
Exactly.
Exactly. It frustrates me a lot. Speaking of science communication, that we make science so esoteric. We really otherize science for people. We like, when you go to like planetarium shows and like, you hear people talk about science with this like big booming voice.
Yeah.
Like, the universe is billions of years old. And you're like, what people tell me all the time when they talk to me about astronomy is that they feel small. They go, how is it that you feel you we're so small? The universe is so big. I feel so like tiny and insignificant. And like, I think that otherizing of science, making it esoteric and making it other, like essentially like building the ivory tower and placing the scientists in the ivory tower, does a disservice to science and makes it feel like something humans could never, like only the great wizards could ever do science. And like, I don't think that's true. Like, I'm a big dummy. Like, I like to tell people, if I can do it, like, if you care about it, then you should do it. And like,
exactly,
it's not an other thing. You are a product of actions that have happened over the 13.7 billion years of our universe being here. Little things that have happened to put you together. It's not a thing where you are apart from the universe. You are a thriving and vital part of the universe. And so I don't like that we make it esoteric. You know, I'm very lucky that I work on something that like people, you know, like I work on methods to find black holes, which is how I was able to work with Raphael with this project. And like, that's a pretty cool thing. But I think that you can do that with any field. Any field, you can find something about it that excites you and that you can share with someone else and excite them. Maybe it's a little harder, a bit of a steeper hill if you are, you know, some subfield of organic chemistry, but I think it's there, right? It's just, I'm very lucky that I work on galaxies, which are like, as I said, printed on yoga pants and stuff.
No, it's so true. And this idea too, that like, the more we keep it in this esoteric place, the fewer people are going to feel like it's for them. I mean, you wonder why we have a real issue in science right now, why we have like the Sisyphean task of trying to ensure that there's representation and there's equity. And it's like, because women and people of color historically were like, yeah, this isn't for me. Yep. And the reason is because we have built up this narrative that only powerful, rich white men have the means or the, I don't know, the pedigree to be able to do science, which is just ludicrous.
Yep. And some powerful white men in science, with or without knowing, will like actively work, keep it that way.
Oh, of course.
Through microaggressions, putting down, you know, female people of color like, you know, that's saying, oh, this is really for you because, so like, it's a thing where it's hard to look up into the, you know, like into the people above you and find a mentor who you represents who you want to be. And then also they're like telling you that actively, that like, oh no, this isn't really for you. This is the problem with science, is that science like wants to otherize science, and that's not going to make science better. It's going to make it more monoculture, and that's only to its detriment.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, Calm. Now, I mentioned them once before, and I told you how excited I am to be partnering with Calm, and that's because I use the app all the time. Calm is the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. So if you are like me and you're anxious and busy and stressed out, and it's really hard for you to kind of turn your brain off, it's really hard for you to take a few seconds for yourself to breathe, to kind of look inward and to become more centered and more calm, as the name implies, this is definitely the app for you. Whether you are scared of meditation or you do it on a regular basis, there are so many different programs to choose from. There are meditation programs that are heavily, heavily guided so that it walks you through every step of the way and you don't have to be afraid, all the way to programs that are really self-guided. So you don't hear a voice at all. There's just a bell to bring your attention back. back. And it's a great chance for you to, you know, become centered at any time of day. I love that there are also incredible sleep programs. And more than that, more than sleep meditation and sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for grownups, they also have a great selection of music, everything from focus music to energizing music to sleep music. And I've got to be honest, I fall asleep listening to Calm basically every night, and I do at least one meditation session a day. I'm very proud of myself. And you can be proud of yourself too, because for a limited time, you guys get 25% off of a Calm Premium subscription if you go to calm.com/nerdy. This includes unlimited access to all of Calm's incredible content. So get started today. Go to Calm, that's calm.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
That's why I actually thought it was really cool when we first started talking that you mentioned your postdoctoral work at Dartmouth. You mentioned your postdoctoral work in Arizona, and you also talked about your PhD studies at UCLA. And you've had multiple female advisors, multiple principal investigators that were women.
My undergraduate advisor, Dr. Ann Essen at Harvey Mudd College, lady. My grad advisor, Dr. Alice Shapley, lady. Mm-hmm. One of my closest mentors through, and one of my great heroes, and like Dr. Jenny Green, who's currently at Princeton. She's there. Marsha Rieke. I work with a guy, Ryan Hickox, at Dartmouth. But now I work with, he's wonderful as well. But now I work with Dr. Marsha Rieke here at the University of Arizona. And like, there are, it's not anywhere near where it needs to be, but in my life, I've been shaped by my heroes who have been female astronomers, female scientists. It's not anywhere where it should be in terms of
representation. It's good to hear, though, like, especially when we're talking about physics, right? We're talking about astrophysics, like, because we often think of, you know, I'm in psychology now. I was in neuroscience. And these are fields that now are predominantly female. But just 50 years ago, they were still run by men and still at the highest levels of kind of control and power. You know, most of the people making the decisions are men. But within psychology, you know, I hear stories from mostly female advisors who are like, man, when I first started, you know, that there wasn't a bathroom on my floor. And like, you know, I was like wearing a skirt to class and here in the comments. And I mean, that shit still happens all the time. But physics we think of as being heavily underrepresented, and it is. But it's so good to hear that there are, you know, people out there who are mentoring, because it's so important. Mm-hmm. This idea of seeing somebody who looks like you and sounds like you and dresses like you and acts like you to help you realize if you're a child or a preteen or even fresh out of college and deciding what to do if you decide you want to go to graduate school, that like, oh, I, you know, that person, if that person could do it, they're from my neighborhood. Why couldn't I do it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's really important. I, you know, by virtue of being a white guy, I never thought about this. And mm-hmm. it's only been by listening to the experiences. I've been really happy about the University of Arizona. We were talking earlier about like no one being able to mentor for alternate career paths. So that's such a common thing that some of the professors here and grad students work together to form like a monthly lecture series where people who were astronomers come in and talk about their alternate career paths. Like that's a thing that like, they looked around and said, you're right, no one was doing this, so that we should do this. And so that's been going on here at the University of Arizona. And I've been actually pretty happy with the representation at the University of Arizona. Again, it's not where it should be. It's not equality and it's not as diverse as it could be. But it's getting better, it looks like, mm-hmm. slowly but surely. And it's only by virtue of the fact that universities are now hiring people who are better, you know, like represent the full diversity of this country. And like, that's great. I'm very, very happy that's happening at the places that I'm going to. Dartmouth, right after I left, just hired Jedidah Eisler, who's an African-American astronomer.
She's at Nat Geo. Woo woo. She does a lot of work with Nat Geo, as do I. And so I've crossed paths with her several times. She's incredible.
I was so happy that Dartmouth hired her because mm-hmm. I think that Dartmouth really, really has like a bunch of cool resources. And I think it'll be really awesome for her to be there. When she got there, I tweeted at her, when I was at Dartmouth, one of the things that I did was write a guide. It's like essentially how-to guides for using the main telescopes there to do galaxy studies, like mm-hmm. what I did. Essentially, because I wanted people who went there in the future to be able, especially grad students, undergraduates, to just be able to like very quickly not reinvent the wheel, but like, okay, here's kind of the basics of how to use it. So I like tweeted at her, here are some guides. You should get undergraduates as soon as possible. Send them these telescopes. You know, like I was really happy. I was at a conference once and this girl who was at a university, an undergraduate at a university in India, came up to me and saw my name tag and went, oh my gosh, you're Kevin Heinlein. You wrote the guide for how to use the telescope. I couldn't have done my PhD if it wasn't for that guide. I didn't think you were real.
Oh, that's so funny. I wonder if she gave you a nod in her dissertation.
You know, she doesn't need to. She did the work. I just wrote a guide. Like,
you know, it would have felt good, though.
I think that if you are a scientist listening to this, the best thing you can do right now is not think that your work is like you are the only person who could ever do your work because you're the only person who could ever have the exact special knowledge. Share that knowledge. Write guides. I like to write guides that start from the point of view of I don't know anything because I love guides like this. I love guides that treat me like a dummy. Oh my gosh, I love a guide that just treats me like I'm a complete idiot. And I write guides that are like, okay, let's say you don't know anything about Linux. Let's just start from there. Here's how to do this and this. And the next thing you know, it's getting you to, okay, here's why we're doing this. And like, essentially from, because I needed that when I was in grad school for so many things.
Oh, we all do. Kevin, you'd be so proud. You know, my master's thesis, I worked in a neuroscience laboratory and we studied all sorts of different things, but we used a special technique where we cultured brain tissue from fetal mice.
Okay.
And it was, you know, from different regions of the mouse brain, and we would culture the tissue. We would do this thing where we could dissociate all the individual cells and then regrow them on these glass plates that had little electrodes sort of etched into them. So that way we could record from 64 channels at once instead of just patch clamping where you're looking at one cell. We could look at the interaction of many cells in a network.
Ooh, that's cool.
Very cool. And so, you know, I was really interested in brain damage, and I was trying to do a model of brain damage and I kept breaking the glass. It just wasn't working. And I was like, oh, but I'm not really that into neurochemistry. I don't want to do a pharmacology experiment. What do I do? What did my master's end up being? A protocol for how to dissect these things out, how to keep them happy and healthy, all of the different chemicals that you have to use, all the different ways that you can fight back against infection because we can't culture in antibiotics, fight back against crystals forming in the medium. It was basically a start to finish protocol for optimizing these cell culture techniques, basically how to run a cell culture lab.
And like, that's not only helpful for the people, but it's helpful for you in terms of learning science communication, right?
Oh, for like, sure.
You are learning the way to teach other people how to do something, which not only helps you hone your own methods because you realize like, oh, why am I actually doing that? Or that seems redundant or that like, it is so helpful to just write down how you do things for other people. I'm very proud. You're right.
Well, and I'm so glad that you're proud because I have to be honest, there's a culture within science where I kind of felt like at the time that the sort of feedback from my professors, it was like, yeah, we'll graduate you, but you're really not contributing anything to the literature. You know, like you didn't do some sort of really novel experiment at the master's level, by the way. And you didn't, you know, it's like, no, but I think I am helping a lot of people because now a bunch of other labs could be set up to find those sorts of things out.
This is the kind of thing that happens around the country, probably around the world, where advisors make a judgment call that is, again, this like sample bias, like, many people who are put into these research institutions, they might be amazing researchers, but they have always worked, like, you don't get this job without, like, doing things that are, like, at the peak of your field. So they don't understand that, like, that's not how all of science is.
Yeah.
All of science is not them. All of science is a rich tapestry of people who work at different levels and work in different projects that are equally as helpful, just not, like, the cutting edge, gotta get published in Nature kind of science, right?
And also, most of those people didn't do that for their dissertation.
Yeah.
They did it later in their career anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, one thing that people don't realize is that oftentimes, if you enter into a lab, whether you're at the master's level or the PhD level, you are kind of stuck working within the parameters of your professor's lab. And so, like, some people are lucky and they can invent their own research projects. Some people are lucky in that they, you know, have carte blanche with the technology that's available to them. And other people are really stuck doing an arm of their PI's project. I was very lucky that I went to the University of North Texas. It's not a tier one school. I had a lot of freedom. I was able to say, I want to do this. But still, our lab used MEA technology. you're not going to do a thesis or a dissertation in our lab without using MEA technology. Yep. If that's not what you want to do, you go to another lab.
Exactly.
And that's pretty common that people are a little bit boxed in. But in a way, I think that that's it's kind of a double-edged sword because there's a good thing that comes from constraint. I think that's where creativity really flourishes is when you have some constraint.
Yes. I think that is a similar thing in terms of, you know, at most universities, they have access to a certain number of telescopes or a certain computing cluster. And that constraint does breed, you know, creativity. But I think that you should, I think that advisors will do well by letting their students fumble around and fail and try interesting things and also kind of figure out what it is that they want. I was very happy that my advisor, it may sound like I'm down on her, and I'm not. She was amazing. I was one of her first graduate students she ever had, and I was not at all like her in grad school. She worked and was incredibly brilliant and insightful and worked very, very hard. And I screwed up all the time and was totally doing something different than what she was in a weird niche. She offered me, here's a bunch of research projects we have. And I grabbed the one that had black holes in it. That was kind of the weird side one. And to her credit, we made that work and she supported me and we found the thing, even if it was a weird side tangent project from what the main thrust of what she did, she just oh, okay, this is what you want to do. So I'm very happy about that. But it's, I think that, more advisors should realize that they're not only going to be making little versions of them.
Oh, completely. And that sometimes in science, things don't turn out the way we expect. And
no.
I think there's a lot of real difficulty with this scientific notion that, you know, we want to be purists and think, oh, in science, you observe and you see trends and then you formulate a hypothesis and then you do null hypothesis testing and ultimately, you're going to have a great finding and you're, like you said, going to publish in Nature or Science. But a lot of times you are doing these investigations and they don't work and they don't work and they don't work. And unfortunately, many grad students are thrown into this position where until something works, they can't publish and they can't graduate.
Yep.
And it's no, let them publish their negative results. That's valuable.
Yep. Especially astronomy is a little lucky because we can do a lot of these negative results can prove to be really good, limits, essentially. Mm-hmm. We know that this type of object can't exist in this density because we would have seen it in our, sample. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit better, but it's still it's rough that sometimes you can spend, years and your results come back and you realize actually we didn't find the thing we did. And it is valuable to still publish those things because as you said, I would go so far as to say that I think the vast majority of science is failures, a thing where you just hope for something and you screw it up. My internal mantra all the time is everything is more complicated than you think it is going to be in every way, which means that you think oh, okay, science is going to be this. I'm going to discover this and we're going to be done. My thing of saying earlier, at one point I'll go, that's the farthest thing we've ever, that's not actually going to happen. Here, listener, is what actually is going to happen. I'm going to see a little smudge and I'm going to go, okay, I'm maybe 10% sure that's a real galaxy and I'm 5% sure that that's just a statistical fluctuation. And I'm 85% sure that I have no idea what it is at all, that it may just be a bad pixel. When it comes down to it, the easy science was done a long time ago and now it's all hard science and it's hard science at the cutting edge of hard science. And so it's just a thing where you just do the best you can and you realize that it will get done. There are people who think science has to be done as quick as possible. I think that that's true in some cases, I guess, but it'll get done. So just do it right. And know that it's probably going to be wrong in some ways and someone will write a nasty, paragraph in a paper. As a person who's been the recipient of many a nasty paragraph in a paper, someone will just call you out and say, well, this is wrong and wrong and wrong. And you can just go, well, yeah, you're right. I thought it was this way. I'm wrong all the time. I'm a scientist. That's what we do. Professional wrong beers.
It happened with BICEP too. We all remember this when we were first looking for when we're looking for gravitational waves. And I say we, I'm somehow a part of this. And the BICEP 2 findings, they were oh, we totally saw gravitational waves. And then later it was no crap, that was dust. But then only a year or two after that, LIGO was cha-ching, we found gravitational waves. So it's not it didn't happen. It's just there's stumbling blocks in the way. And I think publishing negative results is really important. There was a girl in my lab who was working on her PhD and it was really frustrating for her because she was trying to figure out a way to freeze these cell plates so that we could use them as like biosensors. But it's really hard to freeze neurons, and it's really hard to freeze them in a pretty kind of, tenuous, I guess I could say, neuronal network. And they kept breaking, and she kept getting crystallization. And no matter what she would do, what antifreeze she would use, it was really difficult. And ultimately, she just couldn't make it work. And she really felt like she wasn't going to be able to graduate. Whereas, like, I think it's pretty important to say, this is not good for trying to freeze cells. When you use this to try and freeze cells, it rips them in half. Like, all those things are important things so that later, when somebody piggybacks this research, they can go, well, I'm not going to try all those things that don't work and waste all my time. Thanks for publishing that.
Yeah. There's other things in terms of who, like, journals are, you know, like, it's hard for journal editors and peer reviewers to like say, oh, this is worth publishing. But like that, it's just, it needs to be a culture shift, I think, that like, I don't know if it's going to happen ever because of the competitive nature of the field, where we just need to like ease off on the gas. And like realize that like, you know, there is value in this exact sort of thing, especially nowadays when a journal doesn't have to be, you know, actually printed and bound, right? So like you can publish more things and they just, you know, go online and they are things now where it's easily searchable. It's, you know, if you do your due diligence when you start work, you'll go look. And I guarantee you, it's, as you just said, very valuable to learn methods, what not to do, you know, before starting it. That's worth publishing. That's worth being something out there for future generations of scientists.
Well, in that way, I think that physics and computer science and mathematics are really ahead of the curve because you guys publish in the archive all the time.
Yeah. So
you can just get your stuff online, whereas like psychology, biology, like medical journal, we're just so behind.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, there's in the past, before my time, when you publish a paper, you submit the paper to the journal. The journal gives you, assigns it to an editor, but there's like a long period of time between where you go back and forth. And in that period of time, if you're doing like cutting edge science, maybe you want other people to know about this object. And so in the past, you'd have to like print out what's called a preprint of the paper, the pre-published version, and then send it to all the people, like the actual physical copy to all the scientists who might possibly want to read it. But then, they've created a thing called the archive, ARXIV, which is like a preprint archive. It's like a place where now you can, before it's published, go and submit it, and then it goes up on there, and there's like, that's where you go to look for cutting edge science. It's science where you'll look and read, okay, this has been submitted, or oh, we're going, you know, like they'll tell you the stage that they're in and they'll update it as they make edits. But like essentially you can get the cutting edge data and you can get it quickly. And for some people who want to circumvent all of publishing, in a journal at all, like if it's a small result, you can put out interesting ideas or astronomer telegrams or something that's like, here's just a commentary on something, and it goes out in a big mailing list every day.
Oh, that's so cool. It's so helpful. I mean, I can't understand half of them, but it's great to have, and it's open access.
Yep.
Ugh, so important. That's like a whole other conversation, isn't it? Well, Kevin, like we've been talking a lot about the JWST. We've been talking, you like that?
Yes,
sticking with the acronym. We've been, or is that an initialism? I always mix those two.
It is an initialism because we don't pronounce it joust.
Joust. So we've been talking a lot about that. We've been talking a lot about kind of the state of scientific research, the state of what it means to be an academic who maybe is not interested in maintaining our trajectory within academia. You're on the fence now. You've done a lot of work at this point and sort of like, after two full postdocs, you're really at that place where you have decisions to make. Is this something you want to continue?
Yeah.
Do you want to work part-time as a researcher? Do you want to go full-time as a science communicator? Like, what kinds of things are feeding into your decision-making?
So, in the last couple of years, I mentioned that I met Allison at an event. I've been starting to do essentially astronomy talks at creative conferences. I started doing this at a conference that doesn't exist, called Unique Camp, which was in LA, which was like a weekend conference for people who are like own their own business or like, you know, just like were artists of some nature. And like, essentially they wanted to go away and like really think about what it is to be creative and like get recharged. And so I would go out there and do night sky shows. But then I started realizing that like astronomy is a very cool tool to not just talk about like, here are facts you will forget in 10 minutes, but instead like, here's what it is to be a person and to be creative. And like astronomy has a lot to say about that. And so I started doing these talks, and these talks have like led to more talks and talks. Like I got back last week. I was in Barcelona where I was doing one of these, like the weekend before I was in Utah doing one of these. And so it's a thing where I'm balancing doing my research with also developing my like communication through public speaking. And I just started a video series, that essentially distills these kind of into these short videos. This thing that I do, and like this sort of thing is just like been on the side. And then on top of that, I do a huge amount of education around, the area here in terms in Tucson, where like I am talking with school groups all the time and giving keynotes at middle school science fairs and stuff. Essentially, like I'm realizing that I love doing research, but man, there's just nothing like the thrill of like working with some people who've never really thought about astronomy in the way that you're teaching it to them. And suddenly they're like, oh, wow, I thought astronomy was something. I thought science was something that was like, I couldn't get it because I don't like math or I'm not very good at it. And actually, no, it's a thing that like, I was right, is exciting. Like, I think people think, wow, astronomy is really exciting. And then when they go research, it's like, oh God, it's really tedious and boring. And yeah, there's aspects of it, but there's aspects of tedium and boredom and everything.
Totally.
And so like I've like realized that like, I am very enthusiastic, as you could probably tell, about science. I think it's great. I think it's a really cool tool we have to understand our place in the natural world. Like, it's like not perfect. There's many problems with science, but like, I think when it's done correctly, it's an amazing tool. And I think that it's something that like it is curiosity, like with some rules. Mm-hmm. Science is,
yeah,
and I think that we all have curiosity, and I really love giving someone a moment where they can like piggyback off of my enthusiasm for just a little bit, and their brain kind of opens up to the idea of like, oh my gosh, like I love showing people the Milky Way for the first time, and not just showing them the Milky Way is like, wow, it's really pretty, it looks like milk, but like it's the inside of our galaxy. It's like living inside a giant pancake of stars, and like they've never seen that, and they just like that moment of like their brain like changing perspective and thinking about it, like I live for that. That is so exciting. And so it only came by like hook, like by literally forcing myself not to just like do research and then, you know, come home and then go do research. Like I had to like feed my soul in some other way. And this was the avenue that it's taken. And it's been so rewarding because it's like, I was just, I'm in talks to do this next year in LA, outside of LA, for a group of prison inmates, like people who've gotten out of prison and now are working to try to make sure that people don't like commit crimes again, mm-hmm, recidivism,
yeah,
like this anti-recidivism group. Like, and I'm really excited about being able to share this weird like scientific idea and some astronomy with that group, because like that's not a group that I think no scientists go talk with these groups, right? Like,
I know,
what,
yeah.
Like, what I'd love to be is just like a little science bomb that just falls into communities that never get science, to show them like, no, you can be as excited about this as anybody, right? Like, maybe it's not the thing. I don't want to make scientists of everybody. I just want you to think about science, because if you do that slowly but surely, you eventually, and enough people do that, you change the idea of science in this country, which, as you were hinting at earlier, is kind of in a weird down point.
Oh gosh, like, yeah, to say the least.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not just, you're right, it's coming from both sides now. What we see is that there are old school scientists who are like holding their death grip on trying to maintain this esoteric standing, this, yep, very kind of elitist standing. And then from the other side, you have sort of a weird political, I don't even know what this is, this like anti-intellectual movement that is trying to like denigrate academia in a weird way. That's like, we're not somehow not salt of the earth enough. And so it's tough, because then you've got people, like I said, from within the hollowed walls who are like, yeah, that sounds about right. We aren't salt of the earth. And it's like, no. It's tough. It's a really tough position, because ultimately, to exist in this century, you have to know something about how things work. You, yep, just can't get by if you're not savvy about like basic technology,
yep,
and, you know, just basic scientific methodology.
The problem is anti-science is getting to a point where people are being hurt by it.
Oh, of course.
Like, there are people who, because of their fears about like vaccinations and things, like their anti-science takes on that, like people are being like impacted in ways that are not just like, okay, people think that the earth is flat, ha ha ha, like that's really scary to me, that like anti-science like ideas and thinking like can lead to real ills, societal ills. Like and so what my goal is to when I talk to people is to show that science is not about truth. It's not about things that are like, this is true, you have to believe this.
Yeah.
Science is about, here's what things, when we look at it, it says, here's what the, you know, we're actually looking at this and doing research, and this is what it all looks like it says, and that's why we do this. It's not, we don't do this because, like, you're wrong, and I'm right, and we win, and you lose. But, like, because, like, it looks like that when we have diseases, we have these vaccinations that actually do an amazing job to help save people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when science gets like heavily, heavily politicized, people take a side. And like, that's frustrating to me because it, as you said, we need to know something about the natural world, not just for ourselves, but for, you know, society and culture on the whole. And we need to understand that like, that science is just something that we're born with because we're born curious beings. And so like, if we think of it like, it's not something that you can like believe in, it's something that's a part of you rather than like I think of science as, yeah, it's a part of the human experience and the part of human existence, not like a thing that white guys do to tell me when I'm wrong.
Yeah, which is what you're right. That's how a lot of people think about it, because that's how it's been positioned by us for so long. And we're not talking here about like arguments about epistemology. Like, we're not talking about these sophisticated conversations about how do we know what we really know. We're talking about like flat out denialism, which is not even to that level. And it is dangerous. I mean, like, I never plug this on the show, and I don't know why, because it's my own damn show. So I'm going to plug it right now. But you guys know that I co-wrote a book with the hosts of my other show, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. It comes out in October, but you can pre-order it now, like anywhere there are books. And it's called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, How to Know What's Really Real in a World Increasingly Full of Fake. And really what it is about the scientific method. It's about what it means to be a skeptic. It's about understanding bias, you know, confirmation, by all these different ways that our minds can play tricks on us. And we have a whole section, to speak to what you were saying earlier, called Death by Pseudoscience, where we see that people are actually being harmed, not just by global warming denialism, which is rampant, not just by vaccine denialism, which is rampant, but also by like these weird alternative approaches to healthcare, that just because of a basic level of literacy that's missing within the public, people will make decisions that seem rationally like good decisions, which are ultimately actually very dangerous decisions. And it's just so sad.
I think that it's not a hard and fast thing. Like, I think that there are ways in which you can be curious and ways that you can explore, you know, different ways of looking at your own body and stuff. Like, I'm not a biologist and doctor at all. So I'm not like, I think that when it gets down to it, there's certain things where like, there's enough evidence about it that like, if you ignore that, you're actively being ignorant. And like, that is, it, like, if it's just you, like, okay, that's, I guess, you, how you treat your body. But like, if it's, you know, someone like your child or something like that, mm-hmm. like, that's dangerous. And it makes me sad that like, we've gotten to this point where, you know, we've had so much great progress in so many ways in this world. And so like, to hear about that, I'm glad. You should definitely plug your own book on your own program.
Right. Well, and I think to respond to what you were just saying, like, in a way, it's because there is so much progress that this sort of alternative existence exists, right? This idea that, like, the reason anti-vax is a thing is because young mothers and fathers have never seen polio.
Yep.
Like, we have the luxury of not remembering why we need vaccines. And so, in a way, like, we should actually kind of be celebrating the fact that there is a weird anti-vax movement, because it means, oh my gosh, we've come so far. But what I would hate to see is regression because of that. But anyway, we've gone so far off topic. Oh, I want more alsos. I love off topic. Keep going.
Yeah, well, so like, there's just like, I think that the joy of the internet is that it has provided a way for like us to share information in a way that humans have never been able to. But I think that what that came with, it came so quickly that our ability to sift through that information and do and think critically about this did not come in lockstep with the deluge of information. And so like books like yours, which try to teach critical thinking skills, or like, these are vital in this era. Like, it's vital to like arm people with the ability to look at the information that they get from the internet, from magazines, from their friends, and think, is this anecdotal? Does this make sense? Is this, you know, like, cause that's where Like, that's where we get in trouble. And that's the other thing I want people to learn when I talk with them, is I want them to get excited, but I want them to understand that science is about not knowing things as much as it's about knowing things.
Yes.
And it's about knowing the difference between the two and knowing how confident you are and knowing that, like, it's not a thing where we go, this is the truth forever and will always be the truth. It's, this is what I think it might be the case. And maybe next year someone says it's wrong. And like, that's a joy to be celebrated, not something where it's like, you were wrong last year and now, nah, gotcha forever. You'll never work in this town again. Like, I would not be a scientist if I, like, if someone caught me on a mistake and then said, like, you don't get to work as a scientist anymore. Like, it's, what does your data say and how well can you support that? And then, okay. And that is critical thinking about the observations. And I think that you can extend that to everything. And we don't think about how to teach critical thinking as much as we should in this country. And like, I hope that people in this, you know, if you're listening to this and you are an undergraduate and you see that there's a course at your college, there was one at UCLA that I was a TA for that's on critical thinking in science, take it. It will be so valuable. It's such an interesting subject to think about this. And you'll come out being such a pedant about articles. It's awful, but it's wonderful.
Oh my gosh. I so agree with you. And I mean, the truth of the matter is, like, fundamentally, we need to be more humble. I think that's what a lot of it comes down to. Like, we've moved into a political era where, like, doubling down and not apologizing and not admitting our failures has become something that we celebrate. And that's problematic because it's antithetical to the scientific method. And it's actually invading science in a way. And I hate to see that happen because even science, you know, a function of mistake making is that there are people behind the wheel and those people sometimes have self-interest. And so we have to be really good about, you know, not only looking for honest mistakes, but also looking for fraudulent mistakes. And that's why I really respect the science journalists out there who aren't science communicators like we are, but are individuals who, you know, don't sort of cheerlead science, but instead say, I'm going to look at this through neutral eyes and I'm going to point out when people do like fucked up shit. And that's important, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, Kevin.
Yes.
Yes. Every episode I close by asking my guests the same two questions.
Okay.
And they're big picture questions, but you're a big picture guy. I can already tell. So I would love to know from you, when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you, you know, right now in your life, A, what is the thing that you are most excited about? What are you, that's the flip side question. We've got to end on a high note, not a low note. So the first question is, you know, A, what is the thing that you're legitimately like concerned about, maybe a bit pessimistic about, you know, God forbid, cynicistic? That's not a word.
Cynical
about. Yeah. You know, what are you actually really worried about fundamentally? And B, what are you legitimately optimistic about, you know, genuinely, not just to play lip service? So kind of two sides of that coin. They could be the same thing or two totally different things.
So part one is you're asking, if you imagine a version of the future, is it a boot stamping on a human face forever?
Yes.
Or
yes.
My favorite George Orwell quote. I think the thing about the future is that, and this, people ask me this a lot, so I'm going to talk about the cynical version thing first.
Okay.
Because it's, people ask me, and I've, in the last like 2 weeks, I've gotten like 30 people asking about this, like, are we going to move to Mars? Are we going to live on Mars? And so I'm going to be cynical for a second about Mars.
Oh, thank God I'm so cynical about Mars.
I don't think we're going to go to Mars. I think that people will step on Mars, but I don't think that's where the human race, I don't think we deserve it.
And this is like, either. Like, a very cynical Earth.
Yeah,
first.
It's a very cynical idea. People in this day and age want to think about moving to Mars, living on Mars. But like, we have not been shepherds and stewards of this planet in near the way that we would get in any chance to live on Mars. Mars is far, it's cold, it's has water that we may not even be able to filter to drink. It's got fine filtered, finely ground sand that would get into everything. It's not a place for us. It's not a place for us to live. It's a beautiful place for us to send robots that can do a lot of work. Like right now, Mars is like embroiled in like a month, 2 month long dust storm. Like, planet-wide dust storm.
I know. Like, didn't we like lose one of the rovers, like access to a rover?
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to talk to it through that, especially because it won't have access to the sun for its solar panels, right? Like, this would be the life we'd have to live. Like, I cannot imagine, like, being with a group of 10 people in a tiny you know, metal dome, like, and not just one weird social issue that comes up that just makes us all crazy and we can't get away from it. Like, there's so many reasons why humans don't think of like human beings getting the moon or Mars as like our future thing right now. That's, we've got so many other things we need to deal with here on the planet. So the big pessimism is really like, is how we're treating the Earth. It is a very scary thing. I've gotten many arguments with my poor colleagues about my own pessimism about our ability to do something about the planet. The author Kim Stanley Robinson, who wrote the Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars books, wrote a book about like the future where Manhattan, lower Manhattan, is largely underwater, and like how that changes, you know, global politics when the seat of, you know, like finance and power goes, extends into the center of the country more towards Denver because of all the flooding and the, you know, like, it just, and like thinking about that, like not as like a hypothetical science fiction, but like, no, this is probably what's going to happen because of what we're doing to the Earth. That makes me very pessimistic. And that's really frustrating.
That's fair.
To like, to be a person and to just watch this happen and to see that people like actively ignore it through ignorant means and like to just, you know, so, I mean, I bet a lot of people probably give you that answer, but like from an astronomer who like has his head like firmly in the clouds, like 13.7 billion miles away, or, you know, light years away, like it's just sad that like this beautiful, incredible gift we've been given, this planet, we don't deserve this planet to begin with. We're just, you know, like it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Now, optimistically, I think that what I'm very happy about, to get back to science and the demographics and makeup of science, I think that astronomy is trending towards good. There's many, many things that have happened in astronomy in the last couple of years that have kind of echoed world events, American global events as well. Like astronomy's had a Me Too movement, and that's been really a big deal. And like, essentially the culture of astronomy, I'm like actively seeing change. I'm seeing professors taking interest. We got an email around the department about a diversity meeting that would be like a monthly or biweekly meeting to discuss issues of diversity in astronomy. I think that this discussion and this is happening across the country. And like, that makes me very hopeful about future generations of scientists, because it looks like scientists are doing the thing that you have to do, which is where they go, huh, why isn't the culture changing? Oh, I guess it's because I have to do it myself. And essentially just pulling the science community along with it in astronomy. And like, I'm so happy that like, just tonight, sitting around me at this, you know, happy hour with these students, were happy, well-adjusted students of multiple ethnicities and genders. It was not just me and a bunch of white guys drinking beers. It was people like who represent a more diverse future of astronomy. And so what I'm excited about is the fact that the telescope I'm working on, I'll work on it for a bit, but it'll be in existence for a generation of astronomers that are just getting into astronomy, maybe in college or maybe in grad school. And like, that generation of astronomy is more diverse than the people who designed JWST 20 years ago ever thought they would be. And that's an exciting thing to think about. Maybe the discoveries that we made with JWST and the future 30-meter telescopes by the women, by the people of color, by the people who, back when, you know, James Webb was head of NASA, never thought a telescope with his name would be used by these people. And that makes me hopeful. It makes me hopeful that even if, you know, there's lots of bad stuff in the world, like in the minutiae of what people are doing, there's so much good in the world, and that is channeled into such cool efforts. And seeing the people who are going to be using this telescope that I'm, you know, I'm working on, and my team that I'm working with is working on, that's really exciting. So that makes me hopeful.
Hear, hear. Well, Kevin, oh my gosh, it was so fun chatting with you today. Before we go, you have to let everybody know, like, how can they figure out when you're speaking near them? You know, is there a way for that? Should they follow your social media? Do you have a calendar on your website? Like, how can people get involved?
So right now, mostly the way you're going to hear me speak is through living here in Tucson, because I do a lot of my talks here in Tucson, but then I travel to these weird niche things. I try to post a little bit about it on social media, but after the fact. I'm not great at social media because I'm very much humble about this, and but I am getting better, slowly but surely. Instagram is a pretty good place to find me. My Twitter account is mostly a place for me to make dumb jokes for me in the future. So, but my Instagram is Kevin Hainline, Kevin Hainline, which is all one word. And that's where, that's a pretty good place to find out these sorts of things. But also you can go to my own personal website, speaking website, which is kevinhainline.com, which is where you can find, like a link to my, my video series, which is called The Stars Connect Us. And I'm making episodes of that. I'm also working with some animators on a JWST video series that we're going to hopefully put out in the next years, which will be kind of a fun animated thing to kind of make JWST seem kind of fun and exciting rather than like this bombastic future of astronomy thing, like more something that's approachable and exciting and funny. And so that's coming out, and you'll probably hear more about that if you just follow me on Instagram there. And you can Google on YouTube for the Stars Connect Us episode 1 to just start there and find that. But I think that's the best way to find me.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me. It really was a blast.
This was fun. Thank you for having me. I know I talk quickly and I'm rambling and I'm a little sick, so I'm stuffy.
It. Oh, no, I love it. It's like it takes so much pressure off of me. So, yeah, thank you. I had a ton of fun. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.